Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Christy Batterman Jordan, a member of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and your chair for today. It's my pleasure to welcome any new members who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you here often. We're recording today's program, so please make sure now that all your cell phones are turned off and any other devices that make noise are turned off now. Okay. And now I'll begin today's program. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Christy Batterman Jordan, a member of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. David Zetlin is a resource economist and the author of The End of Abundance, Economic Solutions to Water Scarcity. He's a frequent contributor to public discussions about the value of water, and his analysis and recommendations have appeared in the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, Forbes, Bloomberg, and on the BBC. Dr. Zetlin is currently the senior water economist working on a European Union-funded project to evaluate economic policy instruments for sustainable water management in Europe, certainly a broad and complicated topic. Locally, he studied at both the University of California at Davis and the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of the popular water blog, Aguanomics.com, which focuses on the political economy of water. You can find this at www.aguanomics.com. That's A-G-U-A-R-O-N-M-I-C-K-S. Today, Dr. Zetlin will speak to us about California's water future and offer his perspectives on which incentives will motivate the biggest changes in conservation and efficiency as we try to manage our state's most precious resource in the 21st century. Please join me in welcoming David Zetlin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm going to try and speak for about 30 minutes or so. We have an hour, and then I want to go to questions because that's the fun, right? So first of all, let me start with a little Q&A here. Who here is an economist? Raise your hand if you're an economist. Okay, a couple economists. Who here had to look at their schedule to figure out if they could come, had to see what they were going to do with the money, the $20 or more or less? Depends if you're a member. Good idea. Become a member. Who here had to decide to come here versus do other things today before they came here? Oh, wait. So we're all economists, really, right? Because economics is about making choices. And I'm a water economist, so I'm going to talk about the choices that we make with water. And I'm going to break it into parts to early on so that you understand more about the appropriate policies as far as individual decisions are being made and the policies that we make as groups, the social types of policies. And we'll find that sometimes the appropriate doesn't actually match what happens, and this is where I get my job security. So let me back up a little bit and talk about just the basics of economics and the basics of what we all know. We're trying to make people as happy as possible, but we also want to make sure that we don't have adverse impacts on other people. This is an important question. And in order to do that, we want to have proper incentives so that if I take an action, that action reflects the true costs of what I'm doing to not just myself. I know that. I need to take $20 out of my pocket to buy something, but also that it has a proper impact on someone else. And those incentives are some. So I want to get into a labeling problem. So sometimes those incentives, I work on this project in the EU, and it's called Economic Policy Instruments. And that is really like a go-to-sleep kind of title. What is that? I'm not even an economist, and policy and instruments. But then the rebranding of this idea would be market-based instruments. Okay, that's getting a little bit better. We don't have to depend on economists to give us all these great ideas. We understand what markets are. But really what those instruments are instruments that individuals will be interacting with. We really care about what individuals do. Markets are not some kind of beast out there. Markets are just made of people, and people are taking actions. And so in that sense, what we're trying to do is design instruments, if you will, so that people taking their actions are looking at situations with a clear idea of what's going to happen and what the costs are, and that those actions have predictable and predictable those outcomes have predictable impacts on other people and the environment and other places that we care about. So the idea is that we design these things so that they perform well. And as a political economist, I talk about these two things quite often. One of them is efficiency, which is the big economics thing, which is if we have a certain amount of water, how do we produce the most value for the water? Is it going to be silicon chips or potato chips? That's the cliche, right? But the other part is fairness. In fact, who gets the water out there, right? Is it go to you or to you, or does it go to the environment, or does it go to someone downstream in another country? And that's politics. So as a political economist, I actually work a lot on the interface between these two things. As part of that, we need to discuss the mechanisms. We have to discuss the property rights, what I said, who has the right to the water, but also, and the allocation of property rights is typically a political decision, but then how those property rights are used is an economic kind of process. So this is why I'm going to keep going back and forth, and the reason I'm going to do that is because you can't pull them apart. Economics and politics were pulled apart about 100 years ago because it used to be political economy, then it got pulled apart 100 years ago, and that was a mistake because we started thinking about economics as separate from politics and politics as separate from economics. And anybody who's been watching the world, actually full, just period, right? But in the last couple of years, we've really seen a huge pushback based on you can't separate economics and politics. And as what we saw in the financial crisis and the involvement of various political parties and the financial interests in this crisis, we have to also remember that those same forces of political economy apply in the water sector. It's more subtle. Everybody here really does care about that because you're in the room, you said, what am I going to do today with my time and my money? But out there, a lot of people, a huge number of people, don't necessarily care about or even, more importantly, don't know about it. And so in some ways, getting to them is the trick. Getting to them is in terms of setting the policy that helps them make the right decisions so that not only they are pursuing, let's call it appropriate activities for right now, without a hint of morality, but so that their activities don't actually have adverse impacts on all of us and society in general, not just now, in the future. That's the definition of sustainability, after all. So one thing I'm going to talk about a lot today, one of my favorite little acronyms is OPM. Anybody heard of OPM? Whoever read the blog? Other people's money. Other people's money essentially means, and it's very, very big as a topic in water, it essentially means that I, special interest group, would like a glass of water, but I don't really want to pay for it. I'd actually like all of you to pay for it. And as a special interest, I can go talk to my representative or your representative and say, I will do very good things with this glass of water. All I need you to do is give it to me. I'll create jobs. They'll be green jobs, right? And all I need for you is a subsidy of some sort or a tax break of some sort. And I got checked in. I'm from San Francisco, but I missed the local news. San Francisco 49ers are trying to move somewhere, something like that, change stadiums. We need tax incentives because we've been playing here for 30 years or whatever. That's just a game called give me someone else's money. And in the water business, it's been going on for a very long time. Sometimes, and it's very popular in the Western United States, and it's popular also around the world, which is why, in some ways, what I talk about today can be generalized in some ways to around the world, to other spots in the world. The book, in fact, is quite agnostic about geography, but because the policies are mismanaged in lots of parts of the world. So we need to keep track of other people's money. And the interesting thing is, the nice thing is that you actually don't necessarily need subsidies to run almost any water policies. If you're talking about agricultural water, you don't need to have a subsidy. If you're talking about water and energy or water and urban water, you don't need a subsidy. there are people that say, well, we need D.C. to subsidize us. Well, if D.C. subsidizes everybody and everybody's taking money out of everybody else's pocket, after a while there's no money left because it's just dropping on the way around the table. One place, I'm not going to say one place, there are other areas where subsidies are appropriate, and I'll get into that discussion when I overview the book. So, in fact, I'll just do that now. The book is, I broke it into two parts, part one and part two. In part one, it's what I call personal water choices, and that's where we can have a policy that is going to set incentives, and then we just let people run with those incentives. What that means essentially is that if you buy a cup of coffee or a loaf of bread or a gallon of gas with caveats, or you buy a house, those decisions that you make do not necessarily impact your neighbors, right? If we set down the incentives correctly, you could just go along. On the other hand, part two is what I call social water choices. That's where we have intrinsic impact on each other. In this section, we have things like environmental water. That's the big one, right? Infrastructure projects is another big one. And also I talk about other topics that are related to that. So what I wanted to do when I set these things apart is I wanted to clarify what we want is the best policy, and then compare that policy to what's really going on to see where that difference is. And the reason that the book is called The End of Abundance is because a lot of policies were set down in a time when water was abundant or assumed abundant. Because remember, the environment didn't count until very recently. Silent Spring came out in 1962, and that was actually about things like water quality. But water quantity started to become a bigger and bigger issue, and it is becoming a bigger and bigger issue under the twin pressures, essentially, of population growth and lifestyle on the one hand, and then also climate change and our changing perspective on water quality, on the other hand. So demand is rising and supply is falling. We're getting this end of abundance because the what we had before is that surplus is going away. So the theme of the book, the thesis of the book is we set down all of these institutions in a time of abundance. The government will build a canal, will bring as much water as the farmers want. They'll use as much as they want. It won't have an impact on the environment or on the city or even on other farmers. And then we'll sell it for free or some discounted price. And as that goes on everybody gets used to that free water, after a while there's more and more people using more and more free water, and then you have an end of abundance. And they say, well, you can't take away our birthright, which is this cheap water. And then the politicians say, well, we're not quite sure what to do now, right? I'll talk about the Delta later in terms of I'm not quite sure what to do now, right? But that's the problem. The problem is that we got used to this abundance. And I was in Rome about a year ago, and the Roman fountains still flow. Like a little tap comes out of the dog's mouth and just drops water onto the ground, because those aqueducts have been dropping free water, essentially, for 2,000 years in Rome. And the Roman water system is actually one of the worst in Europe, by the way, in terms of sustainability, right? They're running out of water. They've got massive leaks everywhere. And my big indicator is that when they put the little catch on that dog's mouth, and you have to open the catch to get the free water out, that's when they'll start thinking about, we don't have a lot of water in Rome anymore. So that's the paradigm change that I want to talk about. A lot of you already know that's going on. You're concerned about it. But the idea to me is to look at the existing policies and say, can we change those things to take into account the end of abundance? And yet, you know, society will not break down. And quite honestly, the short answer is society will not break down. We can have solutions. I'm not going to call them win-win at all, but we can have very pragmatic solutions that are not necessarily very expensive that will give us a sustainability. And I use sustainability and economics and environment to mean the same thing. We can have sustainability for a long time if we put those changes into place. So that's the preamble. That's the half of my talk, by the way. That's the preamble of what I want to talk about today. Just to preview where I'm going, I'm going to talk a little bit about urban water, agricultural water, environmental water, the Delta, and climate change. So very briefly about climate change. So let me go through some issues in general on water in California. Who's heard of 20 by 2020? That's a state policy. State of California policy, I think it's still supposed to be happening, right? There's a financial crisis, everything goes off the table, right? The 20 by 2020 policy in California is to reduce water use by 20% by the year 2020. Through some curious loophole, I think agriculture was exempt from that policy. Now, actually, let me get into the water accounting, because this is, I think, also informative.
And it's funny because you as soon as you have a debate with people who are interested in California water flows, the first thing they do is they argue about the number. How much water is used by which sector? And using pretty rough numbers, about 20% of the water in California is used by urban interests, let's say, municipal and industrial, and 80% is used by agricultural interests. But the question is, that's called developed water. And what that means essentially is that it's channeled through some kind of engineering construct. If you include wild water, which is not developed water, then those numbers change because the environmental water flows are quite big. The environmental water flows are on the same order as agricultural water. So you can break it down to something like 45% agriculture, 45% environment, and 10% urban, right? So still urban water is quite low. But if you think, wow, 20% of urban water, that's a 2% reduction in total water demand in the state of California by one measure, or it's all the way up to a 4% reduction. So it's not very much. And I'll get into agricultural water conservation, which is another hot topic, in a second. But as far as I'm concerned, we can get 20% reduction of urban water by the end of this year if you want it. The question is, how do we explain this policy of, for example, raising the price of water or inducing conservation to people that like free and cheap things? It's difficult. Nobody wants to pay more for anything. Who wants to pay more for everything? Anyone? Unless you're selling it, right? I want everybody else to pay more for my book, but they doesn't mean you're going to buy it. So the question is not, are we willing to pay more? It's like, what are we buying for our higher price? And when politicians and other consultants and so on, they say, oh, you always talk about raising the price of water. What are you getting for that? You're getting reliability. You're getting a water system that doesn't dry out. You're getting no drought declarations and water cops driving around the streets trying to find a sprinkler head. Okay? What you get is the system that you don't have to pay attention to. It's boring, but it works. I live in the Netherlands. There's an amazing, boring water system there that just works over and over again. And it's just, God, so annoying. So that's why I have to come back to California. So there's two ways of getting to water conservation. What I'm going to just say, generically speaking, is you can raise the price. That's just the basic economics. If I raise the price of coffee, I raise the price of cars, I raise the price of art, the people will ask for less of it. Remember, I'm talking about urban water. We're definitely not talking about a human right to water in developing countries. We're talking about people in California who definitely have plenty of money to buy water. Water is probably the lowest thing on their monthly bill. On the other hand, let me acknowledge right off the bat that price is not the only instrument that you can use to reduce water demand. People can be educated. They can learn. They can change their habits. They can have a new water ethic. And that's great, and that's often cited as the best way to save water, and it's very, very cheap. If people all wake up in the morning and they decide to use less water, that's great. The problem is that people don't wake up in the morning and decide to use less water, right? So we have seen that happen. Australia has this great example of the city of Brisbane was in this crazy drought, and people just stopped using water. The price of water didn't change at all. As an economist, I did one of these things. But basically what people did is they said, you know what, we don't have a lot of water, let's use less. And that could happen, and this is on my blog, I call it the 20-80 rule. Essentially, I say, this is not real statistics, it's just an analogy. 20% of the people will use less water because it's the right thing to do. This is the Prius crowd, right? They're riding their bicycles around or whatever. And 80% don't really care. They're just, you know, I've got to get my kids to school. I got to take a shower. Long showers are great or whatever. They're just going to do whatever they're going to do. And they will pay attention to a price signal, whereas the 20%, they don't need a price signal, okay? But on the other hand, those 20% mean that we're not going to have not everybody's like that. So we help them out with a price signal. And the perfect analogy that I would bring up at any cocktail party is look what happened when gasoline went to $4 a gallon the first time, right? Everybody said, oh, my God, gasoline's expensive. Maybe I should change what I'm doing. The dramatic thing, people actually started selling and buying cars. I thought they would just drive less, but they're actually selling entire cars. Carpool, you know, change, combine your errands and all that. If the price of water would go up, people would use less water. And most important, while I'm ranting on that topic, by the way, is that they wouldn't stop drinking water and throw their children outside into the dust. They would stop watering their lawn, for example, right? They would, you know, not refill their pool every 6 months or something like that. So people will end up cutting off the uses of water that are the least important to them first, just like you would do it for anything else. You would cut off, you know, if you want to go buy music and a CD costs $10 each, you're going to buy a certain number. If it's $1 each, you'll buy more. If it's $20 each, you'll buy less. So the whole point is we do exactly the same thing with water, and that's what pricing signals would do, and you don't need any water cops. Let me talk a little bit about the way we price water in the urban area, and that is basically on cost, the cost of delivering water. And this is interesting because what happens when you price water on cost and you have a very cheap water system is the water is very cheap. This is actually the case in Las Vegas, because Las Vegas gets its water from nearby Lake Mead, just pumps it up the hill, puts it in the system, and off we go. San Francisco has very expensive water because it comes down the hill from Hetch Hetchy through this gravity flow, but all the employees in San Francisco PUC, they have nice offices, they drive a Prius around, they have gold-plated pipelines, it's a long distance, and so on. And that's actually, interestingly, why water costs at least double in San Francisco what it costs in Las Vegas. Even though Las Vegas is in the middle of a desert, constantly on the edge of a water shortage and rolling off into the desert, but San Francisco is relatively humid or relatively well-watered. So the price of water doesn't actually have anything to do with the scarcity of water in some places. And my solution to this water shortage potential issue is that you actually include the scarcity price in water. If water is going away fast, raise the price of water. There is an institutional rigidity and norm that you can't sell water for above the cost because that would be ripping off the people. So there's an answer for that. I can go into a long detail, but the simple answer is you raise the price of water in order to reduce that demand, and then when there is no shortage, if you have too much money, then you give it back to the customers in a check. So instead of everybody would get a check every year, and everybody likes to get checks, right, from the government. So that would be a way, for example, of balancing supply and demand and preventing a shortage, and yet keeping the finances of these water companies balanced and not essentially overburdening your pocketbook. There's a lot more details, but that's just a short overview. I also want to talk about tariff pricing for a moment. There's a policy in front of the CPUC, California Public Utilities Commission. This is the commission based in San Francisco that regulates private water companies or investor-owned water utilities. And a proposal is that the price of water of a particular water company in all of its locations around California will be at the same price. What that means is that if you have you're running a water system in Southern California, you've got one up in the hills, you've got one on the coast, and the coast, Monterey right now, is under unbelievable pressure, and they have some of the lowest water consumption in the state. They want to build a desalination plant there. So that price would go up if they build the plant. But the people that are in the foothills that are just getting all that nice runoff from the snow, under this policy, they would pay the same price in both locations. And what that would mean, this is called postage stamp pricing, the way we send a letter. You can send it across town or to Alaska for the same price. What that means is as the cost of servicing Monterey goes up, the bill for those people in the foothills goes up to balance it. And what that also means is the people who have desal plants don't pay the cost of the desal plant. This is the worst possible way to do water pricing. And the CPUC is considering this right now. If they're looking for public input, I suggest you talk to them, because especially if you're a customer in a low-priced area, right? And I believe they actually want to do that to make their administrative load easier. And the water company likes to do it because it makes their finances more stable. Unfortunately, it has nothing to do with economic or environmental sustainability. So this is a policy that's actually being proposed today, right now, that is the worst possible idea. It's been shown to be the worst possible idea decades ago, and yet it's considered state of the art. This is actually how strange the water world is and why actually I'm constantly entertained and have lots of material for the blog. So let me go on to agricultural water, because I want to also make sure there's enough time. I mentioned other people's money. The Central Valley Project is one of the worst water infrastructure projects in California. The Central Arizona Project is one of the worst water projects in the states, right? And those two projects are never going to pay back the money they cost to the taxpayers. They also provide water at lower prices, which means that they're going to be used more often by the farmers that have access to those projects are going to use more water. How do we know that those projects have value? If you look at a piece of property that's next to the CVP and it has water supply from the CVP, and you look at another piece of property that's the same soil, the world's best soil, but doesn't have access to that CVP water, the price difference in the property is insane. It's thousands of dollars. I mean, we're talking hundreds of percent, actually. The thousands don't matter. hundreds of percent difference because the value of that access is the cheap water. And so that goes into the price of the property. So if you want to know how big the subsidy is, just look at the difference in the prices between these two things. Because if those farmers were paying full price, and they do claim to pay full price on the state water project, which is not true either, if they were paying full price, then the land would be exactly the same price as the land that did not have access to that water. And that's the how we can see the value of those projects. That's also why we can see the value of having lobbyists in Washington or Sacramento to bring more water to your land, because it increases the value of your land. So that's just an indicator. The other part, and how do we know, and I love this example. There was in the newspaper, Temperance Flat is a dam that's being proposed, I believe. It would add yet another, I don't even know how many dams are in California. Hundreds? I don't know. 50, 100? Sorry?
1,400.
Thousands. Okay, 1,400 dams in California. Temperance Flat, $3.3 billion price tag. In the newspaper, the farmers are interviewed. You would take 75% of the water from this dam. Yes, we will. Will you pay for it? No, we won't. Okay. Who will pay for it? Other people. Okay. And this is actually just in the news. Like, oh, okay, great. That's a great project. But that's kind of typical. Again, it just surprises me, but that's the way we go. And you actually have to show up and say to people, the politicians who are approving these things, no, that's not a good idea. Don't take my money and give it to those guys. Just do the full cost recovery. So let me step back here for a second and say, by the way, California has some of the worst water management, not just in the United States, but in the world. So when I'm giving these examples and you're saying, oh, it must be the same other places, no, it's pretty bad here, right? So when I go to the Netherlands and I'm bored because there's nothing to do, that's the same. That's like I have to go back to California and get some good examples. So India's got good examples of bad water management. China has bad examples. I can go into those things, but I'm trying to concentrate on California. I'm not picking on California, but I'm just giving you some ideas that California is definitely the bottom half of water management from what I've seen. And as an example of the opposite of that, consider Australia. I'll talk about water, the water markets that are in Australia and the Murray-Darling Basin for agricultural water. And the thing that I always think is funny is the farmers say, we can't have water markets. We can't have full cost pricing because that'll make us go out of business. In Australia, the farmers what they did is they had a huge problem with not enough water. Surprise, surprise. What they did is they actually separated water rights from land rights. And they made water rights something that you could trade separately. And there's other details. But basically what happened is farmers started trading water among themselves in the middle of this, one of the worst droughts in Australian history. And the farmers who had trees or grapevines, they were buying the water from the farmers who had cotton and other row crops that didn't necessarily need to be in place. And the farmers that were making the most money were the farmers that had the worst land and the worst crops, and they were farming water, right? And what happened overall is that those farmers became very, very wealthy. In fact, their return on investment for water was 15% per year for 10 years. That means you're doubling your wealth. This is faster than China. They're doubling their wealth every 5 years based on trading the water. And the agricultural sector stayed vibrant and profitable, and they didn't run out of food, and there was more water left over for the environment. So there was every kind of possible good impact you can think of by formatting those, putting those markets in place. There were some bumps on the road, you know, there always is, but let's say it this way, at least they've gone there, at least they've shown it worked, and we, people in the rest of the world, but as well as in California, can benefit from that. The farmers in California, this drives me crazy, the farmers in California have the most to gain by water markets. And often they want to do them, but then we go back to the political problem called, can we have water markets? And the politicians say, well, no, we want to tell you where the water can go because that's where a lot of politicians derive their power. So this is the political economy. And I'm not going to wave my hands and say markets, 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 but there is some balancing act that makes things appropriate, that helps the water get where it's going to go. And those things have been implemented successfully in some places. So in that sense, I'm saying just give it a shot, give it a try. Let me also put to rest that canard of low-value crops. Who's heard of alfalfa is a low-value crop grown in the Central Valley, cotton, something like that. Why would a farmer who has choices between crops grow a low-value crop? The number one reason would be that it uses a lot of water, but you can grow lots of water using crops. What the farmer is doing is growing a high-profit crop. And alfalfa, I bring that up as an example because one of the big growers of alfalfa in California is the Palo Verde Irrigation District, which is on the Colorado River. It has the most senior rights to water in California on the Colorado River. They literally can take unlimited amounts of water from the Colorado River, and they actually put 9 feet of water on their land. I'm not Dutch. They have 9 feet of water they put on the land to grow alfalfa, and some of it flows back in the river and so on. And why do they grow alfalfa? Well, because labor is expensive. And alfalfa is just like grass. You just mow it down. So they're making the most profit per unit of water that they can, given that they can only grow things with the water. But when Palo Verde was allowed to sell their water, or they made a deal. They weren't allowed. They were in charge of it. But they made a deal to sell their water to Los Angeles. They were so happy. They sold a bunch of water to Los Angeles, you know, and took care of some of the shortages in Southern California. So those farmers stopped growing that low value but actually high profit crop, and they sold the water to the city instead. It was a voluntary transaction. Everybody's happier. Even the farmers were happier, and the farm workers were happier, and the people that sold, the third parties, the people that sold trucks and irrigation equipment and all that, they were also happier because there was so much cash coming from Los Angeles to Palo Verde, which is literally in the middle of nowhere, that every local business was rolling in cash. So that was an example of how farmers and cities can cooperate for water exchanges. Another thing that happens when you have water markets, and I want to put the chicken and egg in a row here, there's this notion that if farmers would just be more efficient with water, there'd be more water. The first thing that usually happens is as soon as farmers get more efficient with water, they grow more crops. They don't just leave it in the river to let it go away because that water is very valuable. But if you give them a reason to sell that water, sorry, to give them a reason to use less water, which is what I mentioned before, they can sell it, then they get more efficient. And in Australia, the example I said before, farmers have become so efficient at growing their crops that their water, their crop per drop, so to speak, has dropped very quickly as they've had the opportunity to sell that water not just to other farmers, but also to environmental flows. So there's more water in the Murray-Darling flowing towards the wetlands there, very similar to the Delta, and that water is going there through that voluntary process. And the farmers are the ones who, they will invest in efficiency when they can get more money for it because they're seeking profits. Let me also put in a huge caveat that farmers who are tapping water, whether it's their groundwater or it's near to a river or whatever, if you have a problem with the rights to water and you can just take as much as you want and it will deplete groundwater or will empty the water, the wetlands, you're going to have problems, right? So you have to be careful about those situations because the worst situation is when a farmer, for example, sells a surface water right and pumps more groundwater that belongs to everybody, and then those people get really upset. So this has happened in California also where some farmers sold surface water to the city and they pumped more groundwater from under their neighbors, which doesn't make for good neighborly relations. I'll take a brief note on the environment. When I mentioned before, the book is split into part one and part two. I'll be stopping soon. Part two is about what I call social water choices. The environment chapter shows up in there. And the short version is that the environment is definitely all of ours. It's a public good. We have to, what I do in terms of policy recommendations, I say we have to maintain base flows in the environment, whether it's a river or a watershed or anything else, and then whatever's left over water, and that depends on who you talk to. Sometimes zero water out of the environment is all the water the environment can afford, but sometimes there is some water left over, and that is the economic water that can be distributed among different uses. So we leave the base flows in place, and then we can have the allocation of the existing water among those other uses. And that's a political decision. I don't have anything to say except you have to call on not just politicians but also the people, because sometimes the politicians are not hearing from the people. Sometimes they don't want to hear from the people, and that's really quite sad in terms of some of the results we see. This is the worst example of politicians not listening to people is in the Aral Sea in the ex-Soviet Union right now between Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and the Aral Sea it used to be the third or fourth largest sea in the world. And it's been drained down to very, very, very low levels. And the fishing villages are now 50 kilometers from where their water used to be. And that was because the government of the Soviet Union and still the government of Uzbekistan prefers to divert that water into cotton growing. The farmers don't make money off of that cotton, by the way, because the government says at gunpoint, you sell it to us at the price we tell you, and we sell it on the international market and take the cash to Switzerland. So that's Literally, sorry, I'm not kidding. It's Switzerland or maybe it's Luxembourg. But anyway, the cash is leaving the area and the water is depleted from that natural resource. And that's an example outside of California that obviously shows it can get much worse. So you need to have a political involvement with environmental water. There's my favorite example of other people's money in the environment is the Restore Hetch Hetchy idea. And using some back of envelope numbers, I've heard it's going to cost something on the order of $5 billion to break the dam of the Hetch Hetchy. Now, it's O'Shaughnessy Dam in Hetch Hetchy Valley in Yosemite, right, just to get the names clear. The idea is break O'Shaughnessy Dam, restore Hetch Hetchy, put the existing water storage off river. We lose the hydropower and so on. Let's say it'll cost $5 billion. I think SFPUC came up with that. They obviously have an interest in having a high number. Let's just say for a moment it's $5 billion. But when I checked to see who were the supporters to support Hetch Hetchy or Restore Hetch Hetchy, who had signed their names to it, it was something on the order of 5,000 people. So 5,000 people think it's a good idea to spend $5 billion on this project. But I don't think each of those 5,000 people is going to contribute $1 million each. They kind of want other people's money to restore their dream. And that sounds, it sounds great, but when you start, it doesn't, no, that, the $5 billion doesn't sound great, but Restore Hetch Hetchy sounds great, but it does come at a price. And just like farmers should be paying for their infrastructure, environmentalists, if they have a particular target in mind, should be paying for their infrastructure or their lack of infrastructure. So it goes both ways. I'm going to be agnostic about this abuse, but the abuse of other people's money, it happens through the political process. The idea is to keep your finger on it and see where the money is going, because that is easier. It's easier to trace money, by the way, than water. So just keep following the money. All right, let's talk about the Delta for a second. Or not. I told some people earlier this morning that I was so happy to move to the Netherlands and stop thinking about the Delta. I have a couple thoughts on the Delta. At one point, I was alive and kicking in 82 in San Francisco when the vote came up and said, we shall not have the peripheral canal. And I'm proud to say I created the peripheral canal entry on Wikipedia that has since been filled in, I'm sure. But at first, I was in favor of the peripheral canal as the pragmatic way of continuing to export water to Southern California. And then I thought about it. I was like, wait a second. I did my PhD dissertation on water in Southern California. Every time we bring more water to Southern California uses more water. And I wonder, maybe we should roll that one back, especially, remember, since 50 to 70%, depending on the city, 50 to 70% of the urban water in Southern California actually goes onto lawns, right? So if you cut their water supply by 50% overnight, the disaster scenario, we would have some brown lawns in Southern California. They could still have their jacuzzis. They could still have the power showers and washing the cars in the driveways, but there would be less irrigated landscaping. So in that sense, I'm not too worried about what happens in Southern California if they lost that urgent supply. So then it's the other people who are depending on water exports from the Delta, of course, the farmers in the Central Valley. And that's a very complicated discussion about all the different things that are going on there. The basic idea, though, is that with less water, they would shift around their crop mix and spend, you know, Westlands Water District, to their credit, has spent a lot of money and effort on high efficiency drip irrigation and so on. Other farmers are still doing flood and sprinkling irrigation. If there was less water, especially if there was a water market, they would actually move that water around. And let's just say, for a round number, they lost two-thirds of their water supply to the Central Valley. They wouldn't lose two-thirds of the crops, and especially not two-thirds of the value of the crops, because the way that water gets reallocated would mean they would let the cotton go, they would let the wheat go, or whatever else they're growing down there in terms of low-profit crops, and they would maintain the high-profit crops, our California almonds and other those pomegranates and other types of valuable crops, they would still be grown. So the farmers would find a way, like they have for thousands of years, to do it. I think the worst thing is to have the whole Delta blow up in an earthquake and then they're cut off immediately. But politically speaking, it wouldn't be the end of the world for all those people, especially if they're selling the water to somebody else. So that would be the consequence of stopping exports from the Delta. And I'm kind of not in favor of continuing exports from the Delta, but I'm one guy. And this is ultimately, it's a political fight. of what happens in the Delta. And they've spent literally billions of dollars studying this problem. I think we've probably studied it enough. And the reason that it's still ongoing is because it's a political decision that has a winner and a loser. It's not an economic decision which has a winner and a winner that's deciding this process. That's why they keep fighting and keep fighting and keep fighting, spending more and more time and money on the process. So to slow that, to change that over, I've proposed a super radical idea, which is to actually have people vote with money instead of voting with lobbyists and bribing politicians, but literally vote with money. But I think that that situation, I'm just going to try and end my comment on that now and say that's not going to go anywhere as long as there are consultants and politicians who like it not being resolved, and as long as the way of getting it resolved is that somebody's going to win some vote and the other person's going to be an absolute loser on the other side. So I don't have any good news for the Delta. There's a whole paper about this thing that I wrote up if you are really curious. Let me stop with the last thing on climate change. And it's been my observation of going to many conferences and talking to many people that we're not going to be doing anything as far as mitigating climate change. Carbon is continuing to go in the atmosphere. It's not slowing down, it's speeding up. The impact of higher carbon in the atmosphere in terms of higher sea surface water levels, in terms of ocean acidification, in terms of changing weather patterns, which is the really big problem, is going to be there and growing stronger. It'll be, as far as I'm not a scientist, but I've been reading what the scientists say, these effects are kicking in kind of now or before now, all the way out to 2050 or 2100. So when I think, where should I put my money? Should I put my money into a solar panel array, or should I put my money into a wind farm or whatever? I'm sorry if anybody works for a solar panel or wind farm company, but I think I'm going to put more of my money into adaptation and getting ready for things not going the way we like them. So I live in the Netherlands. They're spending $100 billion over a 100-year period to fortify, not just fortify their shoreline, but also allow for bigger flows. If you didn't know this, the Netherlands is not just below sea level, but also the drainage, they're in the delta of several big rivers. So they're going to have not flash floods, but they're going to have big water flows. They're leaving more space for the river to flood because they're going to be getting higher flows coming in from Germany, for example. So adaptation means you have to plan ahead. It doesn't mean that you build on the New Orleans shoreline and hope that another hurricane doesn't come by, right? It doesn't mean you build on Malibu coast, right? Just put more pylons out there. So anyway, I'm going to put a plea in there for watching what you do in terms of your personal, especially your personal investments. If you're buying real estate, watch out for the shoreline and look for flood insurance and so on, because in the future we're going to have a little bit more variability in our climate, and that's going to make life a little tougher than it was before. So I'll stop on that optimistic note.
Well, thank you, David, very much for a very lively discussion. We're going to open this up to questions, but first we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to California's Water Future with David Zetland. So we'll start with you.
I'm curious, in talking about California water, that you didn't mention the public trust doctrine. Mm-hmm. Because the first change in economy was from mining to agriculture, and that shifted water uses. Mm-hmm. And that was the first environmental case in California, and it was a public trust case. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, essentially what happened was they declared hydraulic mining a nuisance. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of agriculture, irrigated agriculture, could be declared a nuisance because of the selenium pollution and things like that. But what happened was the miners didn't sell their water to the farmers, but now the farmers are insisting that if there's going to be any change at all, they've got to be able to sell the water to whoever uses it right next. But what I'm wondering is, you know, that with all this talk about economic incentives, we're dealing with other people's money, and the public trust has enabled us to distinguish between enduring public values and ancillary private benefits. for hundreds of years. And why can't we use that institution as a more reliable legal institution for managing a transition
right.
than economics?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the public trust, I think, also was key to the Mono Lake decision. Is that right? Against the city of Los Angeles. The public trust. So when I tend to talk about environmental water flows, it is invoking this notion of a public trust, that the water is flowing for the benefit of the public. The problem when you have an existing set of flows that are going on is that the people that are using it consider it their property right. Now, in the Constitution of the State of California, it says the water belongs to the people of California. It says that still. Hasn't been thrown away. I know. So, but the right to use the water resides with individuals or with organizations like the Bureau of Reclamation. So changing that right is not straightforward. It is not reliable. It does require lawsuits, and it does definitely require political discussions. So in that sense, there are, let's say, more than one ways to reallocate water among sectors. The public trust is one way, but it tends to be kind of a brute force way as far as some people are concerned, especially compared to give me money, I'll give you water. And in that sense, it's less pragmatic in my mind as a way of moving water back into certain uses. And I think there's a big disagreement on which uses are public trust uses. There are some people who say all of this is public trust, and other people say, oh, maybe half or maybe 10%. So as soon as there's a disagreement on that, because it is an objective, you can talk to biologists. They have the same answer every time. But not everybody's a biologist. So in that sense, it's tricky to figure out the value. And this is actually why I never try and quantify the value of water, because everybody's got their own version of the value of water. And I don't need to know what your value of water or your value of a coffee cup is or your value of a car is if there's markets and exchanges that are going on. I just care that there's things that are being traded. When people... You do have to have money, and that's because the water is worth something to those people that do have the water now. So there's two ways to go about it. I tend to think that markets are easier, and they're certainly easier in circumstances, for example, where you have a bunch of farmers trading water among themselves. You don't need to talk about the public trust at all. So you can have a water market there without having any impact on the public trust, assuming that those environmental flows are taken care of. That's right. That's another example, but we'll get to the next question.
Okay. Another question?
One of the things that's been frustrating in watching urban conservation happen is that some of the very best-meaning water districts are losing their funding
right.
and having to lay people off and can no longer continue the same conservation programs
right.
that they were so progressive in it. I was wondering if you could talk about the tricks that different types of natural resources purveyors have used to keep themselves in business while not selling more of the resources that they...
Yeah. What they do is they put out a booklet with Mr. Drippy telling you what to do, right? So the question is about, it's known as the utility death spiral is my name for it. And the basic idea is that if utility, it's not a basic idea. I have to kind of give you a moment to explain it, but I'll try and give you the basic version. So if people use less water, the utility loses money faster than water conservation goes down. There's two ways of responding to that. Number one, the utility loses money, so they chop staff. Or number two, the utility raises prices, which pisses everybody off. And there's a couple ways to go about stopping that. And the CFOs of these utilities try and avoid that. So that's why they put out this propaganda that doesn't mean anything. There's two ways to go about addressing that. One of them is to rematch fixed costs and fixed revenues and variable costs and variable revenues. I talk about that in the book at length. The other way is a simpler way in my mind is to raise the price of water first in order to induce conservation. And because of the dynamics of the way people use water and they price water, the utility will actually make money. If they raise prices first, the utility will make more money than it loses in terms of that volume. And then they actually have too much revenue. And remember I said earlier that this too much revenue taboo is what they're trying to avoid. So what they do is they, in the situation you brought up, people use less water, they have too little revenue, they file for a rate increase, they get the rate increase, people use less water, they have too little, it goes in the, that's the death spiral. Instead, I'm saying, we're having a water scarcity problem. The managers know that, the customers may not know that. Let's raise the price now. Now we've got too much money,
That's the good way to go, right? Too much money. We've got excess revenue. We can, and people are using less water, but we can rebate some of the water back, money back. So that's my easy solution. But it requires that all of these rate panels and politicians that are overseeing rates allow for higher prices before as a preventative action. And that's it's difficult to ask a politician to raise prices when they think they're going to lose votes. But they have to say, we're buying reliability. That's my bumper sticker. Higher prices buys reliability.
Okay. We have another question.
Yeah.
Are you familiar at all with the latest incarnation of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan? Could you comment on that, especially the financial part of it?
No, and I don't want to.
Well, it's definitely the Rubik's Cube of California politics.
It's like a, you know, it goes into a blender, it comes out the same.
Yes, here's another question.
You didn't mention desalination plans. Would this be a solution or part of the solution?
Desalination plants are considered, in economics we call it the backstop solution, meaning that no matter what happens, you can always build more desalination plants to meet infinite demand, so to speak, in theory. That requires, of course, infinite energy. So desalination plants make sense in certain circumstances as the lowest, as the most pragmatic alternative, and they are, I think people consider it an easy way out from tough decisions in more circumstances. So I know that Marin County is considering a desal plant, Marin County Municipal Water, something like that, MMWD or something. The one in Carlsbad is my favorite in Southern California near San Diego. That one is, they're going to build a desal plant in a community where per capita consumption is roughly 250 to 300 gallons per person per day because they need to keep their lawns irrigated. And they have money, right? So the question is, should they be allowed to do it if they have the money to pay for it? And that now we get back to the environmental question, which is the way they affect the seawater. And as I said before, I kind of wrote off the carbon question already. So, but that carbon also becomes an issue. I think desal plants are usually invoked more often than they should be, is the short answer, because most water managers prefer to bring more supply side than to try and reduce demand.
Another question?
You took the example of Australia where establishing market has a positive impact. Could you talk about that in the context of when water rights are across multiple countries, maybe Europe or maybe even the bigger case, which is near the Emil Islands?
So the question is about water rights crossing national borders, transboundary waters, yes, and how to deal with that. You can't even get to a market if you're still on the political question of the allocation between these countries. I think the worst situation with transboundary waters is the Nile River, and Egypt and Sudan, which are downriver, get 100% of the flows, and Ethiopia is one of the sources of the river, gets 0% in theory. So, and there's lots of other examples. Those are not even close to being eligible for water markets. I think sometimes if the countries use a water market for their whatever their rights might be under some political negotiation, that's the best way of getting value for the water they have, maximizing that value. So they can do that without worrying about their neighbors. The resolving transboundary issues requires often the upstream water country has to be nice to the downstream water country, and it's not always going to happen. I mean, I'm watching everything. China, the Mekong, it's messy. And doing the right thing is not exactly obvious when it concerns citizens of another country. In California, of course, or the western U.S., there's the Colorado River, which flows to Mexico, and Mexico's had the short end of that stick for a long time. But they've been holding the Rio Grande hostage in exchange. So that's not good neighbors relations. It's a tough question, not very much economics.
Okay. Another question over here.
So I agree with you that there should be no subsidies. In fact, I'm a proud daughter of cattle ranchers in Northern California, and we agree there should be no subsidies. We don't want subsidies. If you study the history of California, you know that the reason people are here is because of the water, and it was our ability to manage and control the water that brought Hollywood here, that brought farming here, that we are a high arid Mediterranean-type desert. Mm-hmm. Water disappears, and it comes back and disappears again. So we have inventions here based in California, like the tractor, like the passenger airplane, deep fryers, whether you agree with those or not, and they were all based on our ability to control and manage water. Farmers are paying. In fact, in Siskiyou County, which they are trying, environmental groups right now are working very hard to get rid of four amazing, perfectly working hydroelectric dams. Our water master program, so we have a river running through our property. We have springs. And we can't just take as much water as we want, as you're suggesting. California has a water master program. Jerry Brown recently canceled that water master program. So my parents' water master bill went from $460 on December 9th per year to $4,600 mm-hmm. on December 10th. That's just to have a referee come in and turn on and off your water when you've taken your certain allocated amount that you have rights to and that you pay for. So although I agree with some of the things that you're saying, as a proud daughter of cattle ranchers, I'm miffed at the misinformation that's being shared, as well as we're not even talking about the U.S. forest. Back in the 1800s, when our environment was considered pristine, we had 180 trees per acre. Now we have over 1,600 trees per acre, and trees drink water. So we're mismanaging our forests, and it just sounds like, you know, that the farmers and the ranchers are getting blamed when you couldn't have this building without cow byproducts, insulation, asphalt, tires, ball bearings on airplanes and cars, bullets. They all come from cattle byproducts. So anyway, with dam removal, which seems to be blanketed across the United States, 20 million cubic yards of sediment will be washed out to sea just in the Klamath River dams alone. I'm wondering what your comment is about this blanketed dam removal across the United States, and there's more than 1,400 dams in California. Those are just the dams that are managed by the government. There's private dams as well.
So thanks for the comment. I don't know if we disagree on so many things, because there's a lot of details in what you just said. I tended not to blame farmers so much as government for a lot of these problems. So I think you were asking about dam removal in particular, and I'm not in favor of pretty much any government blanket government policy. It's appropriate to remove dams in some place in terms of costs and benefits on the flows. Depends who owns them. Depends on – that's all I can – I'm just going to wave my hands around that answer. So sorry if that's not adequate.
We have another question.
Australia had to implement a water czar in order to make things work and water to move around. Could you comment on how effective that is? It was.
So, yeah, I don't know all the pages of details on the Australian situation. I do know that the federal government had to step in to change the way the states were managing their water supply. And generally speaking, that was a force at the federal level, which forced changes at the state and local levels for compliance, because the Murray-Darling crosses state boundaries in Australia. What has happened since then is they've reduced a lot of the – reduced is not the right word. They've simplified a lot of the regulations for transferring water among users on the Murray-Darling, which has made things work better as far as the flows between different agricultural interests. And that's been greeted openly and happily by almost everybody in the system. It was breaking the logjam of various constituencies that didn't want to release their power.
Okay, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for one last question.
Where practically speaking, in terms of the big picture, do you see the difficulties, the pushback, the resistance with implementing water markets in California, as you described, to be such a preferable solution to what the current status quo is?
Yeah, I have an example from a couple of years ago that bothered me, so I'm going to name names. Jared Huffman was giving a talk at Berkeley. I think he was the former chair of the Assembly Panel on Water and Parks. So I was talking to some farmers who work next to Westlands Water District, and Westlands at the time in the drought was paying a huge amount of money for water.
And the farmers next to Westlands wanted to sell some of their water to Westlands and make a huge amount of money for themselves. Westlands wanted to do it. They wanted to do it. But then when they put it up for a vote, the sellers, they voted against it because they were worried about weakening their rights to the water, their property rights to the water. These are exchange contractors for people who are in the footnotes. And when I talked to Jared Huffman after his talk in Berkeley, I said, these farmers want to sell it. Can you just affirm that beneficial use includes water trades, water selling? And he said, well, no, the farmers have too much water. So this is kind of a bad way to go about it, in my opinion. It's kind of like saying farmers have too much land. We should take their land also. And the Nature Conservancy is a very successful organization of retiring voluntarily farmland from use and keeping it in as open range. And in that same example, allowing those exchanges to happen between two agricultural traders in some ways would not only reduce the pressure on farmers in Westlands, but also reduce massively the political and media pressure on water in California. So in that sense, I'm favorable of water markets among agricultural interests first as a way of farmers rationalizing the water who have all kinds of different rights among themselves and allowing good farmers to get more water and other farmers to retire.
So this is clearly a massively complicated topic, which you could probably keep talking for hours and hours, but unfortunately we've reached the point in our program where we do need to stop. So our thanks to David Zetlin, the author of The End of Abundance, for his comments here today. We'd also like to thank our audience here. Thank you so very much for your questions and for your attention. And we'd like to thank those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.